Hello, welcome again to RTE's Your Politics podcast, our weekly look at politics from Leinster House.
There is trouble in paradise. The government parties have fallen out with each other.
No, we're only a year and a half in government.
In
terms of this arrangement.
There's a constant charge against me, because he has no case against us when it comes to
subs.
My charge against him is he's obsessed with innuendo and conspiracy theories.
There is something incredibly demoralising and abstract about this annual pantomime.
Yeah, we're in the Houses of Parliament on national television.
Well, there was really only one story this week: Brexit and the convulsions in Westminster over the withdrawal deal, the backstop, and of course that failed leadership challenge against Theresa May. After a hectic few days at Westminster, our correspondent Paul Cunningham has been giving me, as he travelled home through the airport, his impressions of an often chaotic but compelling week in London.
I suppose it was a drama, but it was also a sideshow. What we were looking at was really British politics coming up against the withdrawal agreement and how it is going to frame its relationship with the European Union in the future. Theresa May has survived, but at the same time, we don't see a solution to that problem of the withdrawal agreement and, of course, the Irish backstop. So it was hugely interesting to see how people dealt with the crisis, how they viewed it, but ultimately we're none the wiser as how we're going to get out of the problem.
The phrase Theresa May is using as she meets European leaders in Brussels at the Council meeting is legal and political assurances. There's talk possibly of a clarification to be followed up with a more detailed legal letter, such as the Walloons got over the CETA trade deal. The big question is whether European leaders will look at Mrs. May, will look at her travails and feel like budging.
I don't think so. I was a European correspondent for 4 years, and Europe is a slow-moving machine. But once it gathers a pace, then things rarely change. It's got a destination, and that's where the train goes to. So I think it's highly unlikely that at this point of the negotiations they're going to open up the withdrawal agreement and say, OK, let's have a look at this again. I think it's far more likely that they're going to say, well, the deal is done, and that's really about it, and we can try and send you a letter of comfort and hope that helps, but best of luck. I think that's the most likely thing. And the Romanian presidency, now that starts in January of 2019, they're saying the exact same thing. It's a good deal, you should take it, they're saying to the UK. But as regards opening up the withdrawal agreement, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note former Tory Minister Nicky Morgan talking about a potential split in the Tory party. Certainly 117 votes against Theresa May. That shows that dissent within the Tory party means she can't win the Commons vote, no matter what tweaks she gets to the deal at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the build-up to this, was an awful lot of focus was just how large was this block of MPs who were going to vote against the Prime Minister. And there seemed to be a political understanding that if it was over 100 people voting against the Prime Minister, then Theresa May was in big trouble. But to a certain extent, politics has been turned on its head so many times over the past weeks and months that 117 voted against Theresa May, and she's thanked very much, and took on her leadership and went off to Brussels to negotiate the deal. But ultimately, she has to come back to that self-same Commons. And there isn't a consensus in favour of this withdrawal agreement. And unless she's able to somehow convince Labour MPs to support her, which seems highly unlikely as they want to get rid of the Tories, this deal is a dead duck. And people are already, I felt, already begin to look ahead as to when the withdrawal agreement is lost in the Commons, what happens next?
But here's the big question about the timetable, Paul, that's really interesting, isn't it? And it'll be really interesting to watch Jeremy Corbyn next week, because no other option can come onto the table until Mrs. May's option has been voted down. Now, she's just won herself more time by kicking the timetable back up to the 21st of January. Can Corbyn force a vote on this next week to get his options on the table instead?
It doesn't seem so. I mean, this is a government and the government orders the business, and the government has said that the issue of the withdrawal agreement is not coming up next week. So that would seem to lock that down until January. And I think that's probably what Theresa May is playing for, that with the time clicking down, that this has to have gone through the Commons by the third week in January, and that maybe she's trying to put the MPs to say you've got this deal or no deal. And everyone realizes that's the case because the deadline is just so close. But I think just talking to MPs from both Labour and the Conservative Party, that they would still vote this deal down even if it's presented at the last minute.
The question is there enough of a majority to stop a no-deal Brexit happening, or can the Brexiteers simply by dragging out the process ensure that that's what happens?
Million-dollar question, and the short answer is we don't know. We simply do not know what's going to happen. And I feel confident as a correspondent being able to say that to you, because I was talking to MPs and many experts, including some ministers as well, and they didn't have a clue either. I mean, we're really in uncharted territory.
So I won't be asking you for any New Year forecasts on Brexit then, Paul?
I think that would be fair to do. I could fill the time, only I don't think I'd illuminate it very much.
Well, answer me this question then, because in Kremlin we had Anna Soubry coming on the radio on Morning Ireland apologising to the Irish people for what her party and what her country were doing. There are an awful lot of impassioned voices we saw in Westminster this week talking about the need for a people's vote, a second referendum. Is it possible, increasingly possible, how possible, that because the politicians can't sort out this mess, it will be up to the people of the UK to sort out this mess in another vote?
Well, what Anna said is mirrored by a number of other Conservative MPs. Philip Lee was another one. He too apologised to Irish people, saying, you are not to blame for this. This is a problem of Britain's making and it needs to find a way out of it. And he was of the view that when the withdrawal agreement was gone, Parliament would remain locked and the only way you could unblock that was not through a general election, but was through a second referendum. And he put that sort of around 50-50, because in the event of a referendum, you could stop the Brexit clock, you could stop Article 50, and that would buy a number of months. But let's be honest, even if there is a second vote on this issue, it's going to be incredibly nasty, one would imagine, and the outcome mightn't be any clearer. So we are still in very dangerous territories, and as everyone in Ireland knows, while it'll be bad for the UK, they'll be the worst affected. Mm. Ireland will be the next worst affected after that.
And watching you there, Paul, and you know the world's media and all those tents outside Westminster and so on, do you think they get, even with all the attention that's on them, those politicians inside that UK Parliament, that the mother of all parliaments, to many outside viewers, some of the scenes looked as though it's frankly lost its marbles?
I think that is the European view. People are looking in, trying to guess what's going on. Guy Verhofstadt, the head of the Liberal group, was saying he could no longer follow British politics because it was simply incomprehensible. I think at the core what you do have is a block of people within the House of Commons who view it as an article of faith that the UK needs to be able to navigate on its own. And when you're talking about principle and high principle like that, then other matters don't come into consideration, such as short-term effects. You're able to argue that we will get through it. And that's the territory we're in, because mostly if we're talking about a deal, you're talking about compromise. But for many people, they don't want to compromise.
From Land of Hope and Glory to Ersun the Heron now. Brexit's impact on what's happening in Irish politics, well, that was really made clear this week on Wednesday when Micheál Martin rose to speak and said this.
Fianna Fáil will extend a guarantee that government will be able to operate throughout 2019. And this will allow the introduction of any emergency legislation and budgets, as well as the full end of year budget and associated legislation. This will in turn allow the holding of an election early in the following year. Free of Brexit uncertainty, there can be an election about the need for a new approach to housing, about ending systematic political failures in health, and about addressing the needs of people who want a government which understands their concerns. This decision has been reached reluctantly, but it is unavoidable. We've all seen in Northern Ireland what happens when political parties undermine the functioning of government at a moment of critical risk. Northern Ireland's position has suffered dramatically from political game playing and the absence of a democratic voice.
Our editor David Murphy and correspondent Micheál Lehan are with me. And Micheál, you see there very starkly the impact that a hard Brexit could have on our politics. The two centre parties yoked together, holding the centre firm in this moment of crisis.
Clearly, and that is the reason for it all, and that desire not to have chaos here. In some ways, it provides the perfect cover politically. You don't have to go into the details of anything else. And there is a political calculation there as well, clearly, that anyone to even think about calling an election at this point probably wouldn't be rewarded. Indeed, such was the bleak black picture that Micheál Martin managed to conjure up there. Even some of those on his own side who feel very uneasy about that, perhaps in that moment felt that it was the right thing to do. Of course, that isn't consistent, and there, I think, is a realisation among the leadership they have to sell this. And we've already heard from the likes of John McGuinness, who are uneasy about this. But of course, John McGuinness was opposed to this from the beginning as well. But it's Brexit, the uncertainty created by it, and the possibility that something bad could happen, something that will alter all the figures, and whatever spending plans you might come up with at the moment will be thrown away at the very least.
And interesting to hear, David, Micheál Martin, the compare and contrast he was doing between the two centre parties in the south and the two parties across the border in Northern Ireland in this moment of crisis.
Well, that's right. It is worth bearing in mind that the people in the north don't have representation in Stormont, and then with the situation where Sinn Féin aren't taking their seats in Westminster. One criticism that's been levelled at both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in relation to this confidence and supply extension is that there is no documentation backing this up, in the sense, what is the price of supporting the government into 2020, when we had this deal initially announced? We got a fairly extensive document saying this is the plan, this is the basis upon which Fianna Fáil will continue to allow this government to remain in office. Now it's been extended and we don't know exactly what the commitment is. Yesterday we had Simon Coveney saying, well, you know, some legislation will be prioritised because Fianna Fáil feels it's important, but we don't know what that legislation is.
What's in this for Fine Gael, Micheál?
Clearly they have made the calculation, despite many conversations, despite many people in Cabinet having a desire, especially during the summer, to go for an election, that it wasn't a runner. And ever since that letter went out to Micheál Martin, it does seem at this point that the Taoiseach was trying to nail things down. Some say it was a calculation, it was a bid to try and force that election before December. So it does present, again, a party that is committed to stability, they can say, and putting the national interest first. It does give Leo Varadkar another year as well. Fianna Fáil, some at least, will look at that and say, well, that offers them the possibility for a slip, this great slip that Fianna Fáil thinks may come at some point and narrow that gap in the opinion polls. But the longer Leo Varadkar is in the job, the more crisis he faces, then he does assume the role even more. And of course, the way he came to that job wasn't through an election by the people. So every minute will probably be beneficial. Some of his cabinet colleagues won't feel that way, particularly, I would think, the housing minister and the health minister, who perhaps, it is said, would have liked an election.
And indeed, the pressure continues, the crises in health and in housing. Sinn Féin say this leaves them as the main party of opposition. But also, it's interesting, isn't it, in relation to Brexit, they are keeping this call for a border poll. And this has been roundly condemned by the other two parties as being irresponsible at this time of Brexit uncertainty, David.
Well, I think it's worth thinking about what exactly would a border poll mean. And in reality, we can see that the North runs a deficit of £10 billion sterling every year. So we need to think, where is that money going to come from and how would that be dealt with? And many people spend a lot of time in the north. I have a lot of in-laws in the north, spend a little bit of time there. And you can see there's a huge difference in the health systems. Very few people in the north have private health insurance. In the south, it's very popular. Also, in the north, if you're unemployed, you're going to be getting less than £70 sterling a week. In the Republic, you're getting over €190. So you're going to have to look at integrating social welfare systems as well. And it's a very, very big thing to contemplate reunifying the island of Ireland economically, whatever about politically. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you want to throw it into the mix with Brexit underway, who knows?
But interesting as well, and again, this was striking, these little moments that stand out in these weeks of drama. Theresa May herself in the House of Commons this week talking about the constitutional status of Northern Ireland as being potentially at risk of her Brexit plan did not go through. So maybe, Micheál, the historians, when we look back, the genie of Northern Ireland status, which we thought was settled by the Good Friday Agreement, will have turned out to have been unleashed from the bottle at this time.
Maybe, even though the opposition to what Sinn Féin had to say there was strident for a number of reasons. There is nothing that scares government and the parties down here more than that. And I do know for a fact that even the whole idea of putting anything on paper around planning in this would never be contemplated because of the fear that it might create if it was ever discovered. I suppose it's over a decade now as well since Joe Higgins went in and accused Bertie Ahern of rifling through his wardrobe and taking on his clothes, his socialist clothes at the time.
I was wondering there for a moment.
from a Sinn Féin point of view, though, they must have looked at their wardrobes at certain points in the last year and thought that Leo Varadkar had been through there. Such was the rhetoric and essentially the pitch to maybe not the Sinn Féin core vote, but to new voters who might have been looking in the Sinn Féin direction. Mary Lou MacDonald insisting upon this and raising it repeatedly through the week draws a distinction now between Fine Gael and Sinn Féin on that.
Other matters going on in Leinster House this week, David. It looks as if the government will get its legislative deadline on delivering abortion services into law. They'll get that through, but possibly not the services themselves by the 1st of January.
Well, I think there's been a number of concerns raised by some people in the medical profession about the speed at which they will get the services through. Others, for instance, Peter Boylan, who is advising the government a little bit on this, have said, well, actually, there is information out there. We have been engaged in a process of education. And certainly in early January, it will be underway. I think politically, Simon Harris would really like to have this underway in January. It shows he's delivering on a commitment.
All right. One other issue that's been cropping up this week, an issue that featured very heavily, of course, in the presidential campaign. President Michael D. Higgins, presidential expenses.
Yeah, and the commitment was made to give the breakdown on that, and they have arrived today. That expense account, of course, that has been there since 1938, but the £317,000 paid every year was the subject of much debate. And you can see that there are a significant amount of money put there for hospitality and the like. Food and beverage, we know now, just in the year 2012 alone, ran to about 160,000. Entertainers' fees, quite high as well. Even things like transport and gifts, about 40,000 in that year. Overall, though, I think President Michael D. Higgins will point to the fact that he didn't spend all the money. In fact, there's the guts of 240,000 of an underspend that will be returned to the Exchequer. It gives you details of the kind of events that were held in Áras an Uachtaráin and the cost of them. And the numbers, too, it's about 140,000 people that turned up during the first term of the president for what are termed in-house events.
One other thing we don't have much detail on yet, David Murphy, but the government says we will get it next week. Their preparations for the impact of a no-deal Brexit, a hard Brexit, on Ireland come the end of March.
The interesting thing about this is that we do know the European Commission has published about 70 documents in relation to preparation for a hard Brexit. So far, the Irish government hasn't published any documents. It has spoken in a bit of detail about employing extra people in terms of the area of veterinary and customs. But the big question is, there are some real pinch points. Aviation would be one, medicines would be another, foodstuffs would be another. What exactly is the plan to deal with all of this? Interesting in the Doyle this week, the government coming under some pressure to give more details regarding their plans to handle a hard Brexit. It's a space I would watch.
Yeah, lots of pinch points involved in Brexit. We've heard about what's been going on in Westminster. We've been talking about what's been going on in Leinster House, all dominated, of course, by Brexit. But it's not just the British Parliament, which has been obsessing us this week as it wrestles with this, that is going to have a vote. The other vote, of course, is in the European Parliament. They've been meeting in Strasbourg, and Conor McMorrow has compiled these opinions. Have a listen.
Following a high day of drama in London on Monday, plenary opened on Tuesday with the Commission President adamant that the withdrawal deal, agreed in November, will not be revisited. He moved to reaffirm Europe's commitment to the backstop.
The big problem, of course, is the backstop for Ireland. We have a common determination to do everything to be not in a situation one day to use that backstop, but we have to prepare it. It's necessary. It's necessary for the entire coherence of what we have agreed with Britain, and it's necessary for Ireland. Ireland will never be left alone.
And the Parliament's Brexit coordinator adopted a similar tone about Ireland.
We will never let down our Irish friends. It's out of question to renegotiate the backstop on Ireland.
Well, I'm joined now in studio by DUP MEP Diane Dodds, Deirdre Clune of Fine Gael, and Leonie Rida of Sinn Féin. Diane, what's your reaction to Jean-Claude Juncker saying that the withdrawal deal is the best deal possible? There's no change going to be made to the backstop.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? That's exactly what I'm tempted to say. You know, Europe has said the deal's the deal. We're not going to move away from the deal. But the absolute fact of the matter is that this will not get through the House of Commons in London as it currently stands. For us in Northern Ireland, the backstop creates barriers to our most important market. And the advice of the Attorney General is that for Northern Ireland, GB would be treated as a third country. Now, I think that I can't understand in what world you would imagine that that was a good place to be, since that 70% of everything we make goes to market in Great Britain. Similarly, 70% of everything we buy in, either for the manufacturing process or to sell in the high street, comes from Great Britain. And we think, and as do many within the Parliament, believe that this rupture of the internal market of the United Kingdom would be bad economically for the United Kingdom and would be bad constitutionally for the United Kingdom. So therefore, it is absolutely clear that there is a very wide spectrum of debate right across the House of Commons that will not accept this deal. And they are also saying that clarifications will not cut it when it comes to actually doing this. And I think that is what's led to the events then around Prime Minister May and the vote of confidence as well. So, you know, I think that Europe will have to stand back at some stage and say, you know, there are issues here. We will have to deal with the issues, because otherwise we can't get the deal over the line.
Diane, if you look back at the history of this European Parliament and Ireland and Northern Ireland's involvement, the seeds of the peace process were helped along here by people like John Hume and Ian Paisley forging alliances out here on neutral ground. Given that you're going to now leave, does that make it more difficult for power sharing to get going in Northern Ireland? And would you not agree that the European Parliament has been positive in terms of creating peace in the North?
Well, I have always said that actually Europe has been helpful to Northern Ireland when Europe took a neutral stance on Northern Ireland. What has actually happened now is that Europe has sided with one particular side of the debate, and I think in doing so contravenes the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement. The Good Friday Agreement gave rights in equal measure to both communities in Northern Ireland. And what we have seen now is the backstop pushed by the European Commission, by Michel Barnier and by the Irish government, has utterly divided opinion in Northern Ireland, so that we actually have a situation, the rarest of situations that you could actually imagine, where all of unionism, all of political unionism, says the backstop is bad economically and constitutionally for Northern Ireland, and the only people who are supporting the backstop is nationalism and republicanism. The very, very rare situation is that Sinn Féin actually agree with Theresa May and the Tory government on the issue of the backstop. So, you know,
is it not a safety net?
Well, you know, again, we're told, Conor, that the backstop is a safety net. Don't worry about it, it'll never be used. And then when Karen Bradley, the Secretary of State, comes to Northern Ireland, she says, we're offering you the best of all worlds, the backstop's the best thing ever. Which is it? It can't be both.
Well, you're certainly not offering any solution or alternative either, Diane. And let's not forget the DUP were never enthusiastic about the Good Friday Agreement and signing up for that. So, look, I think this is about how we're going to go forward, ensuring that the north of Ireland is not abandoned. The Irish government really have to step up and put the pressure on to ensure that we continue to get support from the EU27. Because, look, the backstop is not the most elegant solution, by no matter means, but it is a starting point, and it is something that has to be put in place, because the date is coming now for leaving, and really we cannot continue, and it's unfair on your constituents, which you're abandoning, in my view, to leave them dangling, wondering in or out, what deal are we getting, and the trade implications, all of that is there. So I think the time has stopped for procrastinating now from the DUP and the Tories, and we have to come to some deal. And we cannot continue with this reckless abandonment forever.
in any sense at all, we have said very, very clearly we will vote against the deal because we don't think that it is good for Northern Ireland constitutionally or economically. Having said that, we have always said that we want an orderly withdrawal from the EU. We want a deal that is good for Northern Ireland. We want a deal, indeed, that is good for our neighbours in the Republic of Ireland, bearing in mind that their biggest market is the Great Britain market. In relation to uncertainty, this deal throws up all the uncertainties of the world out there because actually what it doesn't do is actually it gives us two more years of horse trading and negotiation before the only certain thing is that in 2020 we will all end up either in a further transition period or within the backstop.
It gives you two years in which to negotiate what that future arrangement would be. I mean, we are 2 years on and we still don't know what type of future arrangement. You speak about your constituents, and I mean, everybody wants Northern Ireland to thrive economically and politically. It'd be wonderful if the institutions there were established and both parties that you're involved in could provide that leadership and that representation that members in your party have been elected to provide, and we don't. We have that vacuum. We have no
That's
political voice
from
Northern Ireland.
Hurlers on the ditch, but, of course. What would you expect from the Gael?
But just to say, you know, what this future arrangement will be is about where do we want to be in terms of trading with the rest of the world, with the rest of Europe? Do you want to be outside? Do you want part of the customs union or the single market? Do you want Norwegian plus situation or not? I mean, there are all the scenarios, but we need to get to that point.
Dionne Dodds, Deirdre Clune, Leah and Rita, thanks for your time. Thank you.
So we're wrapping up now, and we don't have a moment of the week for you, David Murphy, do you? We have a centenary to talk about, Votaw.
That's right. December 1918, which was the first general election when some women were allowed vote. It was the only 32 county election, and it happened 100 years ago. It's interesting, 100 years later, this week, we have Sinn Féin's leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, talking about a united Ireland in the Dáil. And at the same time, we had the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, also talking about a united Ireland for a whole set of different reasons, because her Brexit plan is in an awful lot of difficulty. And here's what Simon Coveney had to say as the Dáil marked the first general election, this time 100 years ago.
It was the election which saw women vote and run for parliamentary seats for the first time. And it was the election which saw huge swathes of Ireland's disenfranchised poor, those without a property, vote for the first time too.
And indeed, David, in all the commemorations, and there have been many events here in Leinster House and in the Royal Irish Academy, RTE will be marking the event. David McCullough is going to be restaging the 19 election results programme. But that issue, the fact that the issues that were, if you like, bedeviling Irish and UK politics 100 years ago, that they're still being discussed now, they're still points of contention now, and we'll be talking about them in podcasts to come. Today's, this week's politics podcast from the RTE Politics team was produced by Jack Good, edited by said David Murphy, and we're going to talk to you again next week. Talk then.